Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 25th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows a disheveled-looking Donald Trump with an anguished look on his face. He's actually backed up against a brick wall, and there are police cars, looks like four police cars, with their lights shining on him. He's grimacing. There's actually a couple of rats on the ground around him. And the headline is Busted in Georgia, Why His Fourth Indictment is the Most Dangerous for Trump. And that is our first main story. We'll read two today, but we'll start with that one. Trump charged in Georgia with racketeering. What happened? Donald Trump's legal peril deepened this week as a grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, charged him and 18 co-defendants under racketeering statutes for trying to overturn his 2020 electoral loss in the state. It marks the fourth time the former president has been criminally indicted since March. Refusing to accept that he had lost to Joe Biden, Trump and the others knowingly and willfully joined a conspiracy to unlawfully change the outcome, said the 98-page indictment, whose 41 counts include conspiracy to commit forgery, filing false documents, and impersonating a public officer. District Attorney Fannie Willis, who conducted a two-and-a-half-year-long investigation, relied on Georgia's Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, R-I-C-O, typically used to prosecute mobsters and drug rings, to charge Trump and his allies with engaging in a criminal enterprise to keep him in the White House. Co-defendants include former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, and former Trump attorneys Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, and Sidney Powell. The indictment charges that Trump and others pressured state officials to change the outcome, falsified documents to create a slate of alternate electors, tampered with voting machines, and harassed and intimidated election workers. It cites the now infamous call during which Trump pressured Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find the 11,780 votes needed to reverse the results, with the then president warning the state official he could be charged with a criminal offense if he didn't comply. Willis said she intended to try all 19 defendants together. Trump called the indictment an effort by a very corrupt district attorney to derail his 2024 campaign. He said he will issue a detailed report that will exonerate him with irrefutable evidence of Georgia election fraud. What the editorial said. Willis has brought a compelling and necessary case, said the Washington Post. By zooming out to target Trump's many co-conspirators along with him, this indictment captures the sweep of a conspiracy to subvert the democratic process. Any official or political fixer tempted to try a replay in 2024 has now been put on notice that robbing voters of their say comes with consequences. Willis' indictment reads like an exercise at throwing everything at the jury to see what might stick, said the Wall Street Journal. By reaching for Georgia's RICO laws, she's treating Trump's desperate bumbling bid to reverse the election as if it were a genius calculation. Trump's conduct after the 2020 election was awful, but prosecuting it as a criminal matter instead of leaving the judgment to voters and history still seems like a bad idea for the country. What the columnist said. This is the indictment that should worry Trump most, said Kim Well and the Bulwark. A conviction under Georgia's RICO laws carries a minimum 5-year term. This is a state case, not a federal one, which means that if Trump wins in 2024, he can't evade the law with a self-pardon or an order that the Department of Justice drop all charges. In addition, the trial will connect viscerally with jurors by showing that Trump's astonishing recklessness harmed real people. Election workers Ruby Freeman and daughter Shay Moss, who faced an avalanche of threats after Trump and Giuliani falsely claimed they stuffed the ballot boxes to steal the election. Race will be front and center in Georgia, said Richard L. Hansen in Slate. Freeman and Moss are black women, as is Willis, and Trump has a history of being especially hostile toward black women. It's no accident Trump focused his 2020 fraud claims on Atlanta and other Democratic cities with large black populations. The message was clear. Minority voters were stealing the votes of Trump's white rural supporters. Instead of reflexively defending Trump, Republicans and conservative media must come to terms with Trump's legal peril, said Noah Rothman in National Review. With 4 pending trials and 91 felony counts, Trump will spend primary season in and out of courtrooms. If even one case is tried before the election, it will be the media event of this century. A recent poll found 65% of Americans see the charges against Trump as serious. Is he really the party's strongest candidate? What was once unprecedented has now become surreally routine, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. The 4 indictments detail an alleged presidential crime spree of epic proportions, and yet they fail to dent Trump's support among Republicans. Not long ago, a presidential campaign could be derailed by a past DUI arrest or swiping lines in a speech without credit. The notion that a rap sheet of 91 felony counts wouldn't disqualify Trump from seeking a return to the White House would have stunned the 44 presidents who came before him. And the second main story, Maui counts the dead after apocalyptic wildfire. What happened? Recovery workers using cadaver-sniffing dogs were searching the charred ruins of Lahaina this week after the historic Hawaiian town was obliterated by the deadliest U.S. wildfire in more than a century. At least 106 people are known to have died in the Maui inferno, but Hawaii Governor Josh Green said the toll could double over the next week. Many survivors said they received no warning from authorities as the blaze, moving as fast as a mile a minute, spread from surrounding grasslands into Lahaina's densely packed neighborhoods. Some residents rushed into the ocean to seek safety. Others were incinerated in their cars as they tried to escape on the only highway out of town. Authorities said most bodies will have to be identified by DNA and warned that many children left at home while schools were closed are likely to be among the dead. I don't have words to express how much my heart is breaking now, said one school teacher who is volunteering at a shelter in the hope of finding some of her students. While the cause of the wildfire is not yet known, experts believe it was fueled by a months-long drought and 80-mile-per-hour winds whipped up by an offshore hurricane. One Lahaina resident said that hours before the blaze engulfed the town, a power line had snapped and ignited a patch of dry grass. Lawyers representing Lahaina residents have filed a class action lawsuit against the utility, Hawaiian Electric, saying it should have shut off power as winds picked up. Officials have forecast that the cost of rebuilding on Maui, where more than 2,200 buildings were destroyed, could near $6 billion. What the editorial said, Hawaii's economy relies heavily on tourism, said the Honolulu Star Advisor. But now is not the time to visit West Maui. We do not want visitors competing for hotel rooms with the thousands of residents who have been left homeless or with the recovery workers who are desperately needed to restore the necessities of life. Power and cell phone service have not yet been fully restored. Water supplies may have been contaminated by fire-release toxins. To people outside Maui who want to aid the recovery, you can help from a distance by keeping a distance. Democrats have been quick to blame the carnage on climate change, said the Washington Examiner. The real culprit is the invasive grasses that cover a quarter of Hawaiian territory. Ranchers began planting those species in the 18th century for cattle to forage. And when plantation agriculture waned, the grasses overtook fallow fields, providing plenty of dry tinder. Democrats' attempt to exploit this tragedy for their eco-agenda only distracts from on-the-ground fixes that can slash wildfire risk. What the columnist said, arguments over how much to attribute the tragedy to climate change are pointless, said David Wallace Wells in the New York Times. We can't know definitively whether global warming worsened Hawaii's drought or whether it intensified the passing hurricane, but this is how climate change works. Not single-handedly, but together with randomness and existing hazard, and by making familiar risks worse. And we are not sufficiently preparing for those increasing perils, whether it's fires or floods or extreme heat. There are no obvious excuses for the lack of readiness in Maui, said Costas Sinalakis in the Wall Street Journal. None of the 80 warning signs on the island sounded, and broadcast alerts and social media posts were useless to islanders without power or cell phone service. Firefighting resources were spread thin, with only 65 firefighters on the island. Survivors are right to wonder whether this was a natural disaster or one caused by very human failures. The urge to rebuild is strong, said Naka Nathaniel in Honolulu's Civil Beat. But we Hawaiians must do so without repeating past mistake. This was a human-made disaster generations in the making. Extractive farming methods allowed invasive weeds to spread. Luxury tourism has exacerbated water shortages and sent Maui's average home price soaring past $1 million. Priced out from their own land, more native Hawaiians now live on the mainland than here. If these deeper problems aren't addressed, more of us are going to die or be displaced. Our controversy of the week. Hunter Biden, will a broader probe damage his father? President Biden's reelection campaign faces two real tripwires, said Jonathan Lemire and Holly Otterbein in Politico. Joe Biden's age, 80, and the investigation into his son Hunter. Just weeks ago, the younger Biden, 53, was mere minutes from finalizing a plea deal that would have spared him any prison time on gun and tax charges. The deal collapsed when a Trump-appointed judge questioned whether the plea deal would give Hunter blanket immunity for his shady business dealings overseas while his father was vice president. As a result, Attorney General Merrick Garland last week approved the request of Prosecutor David Weiss to continue his five-year investigation of Hunter as a special counsel, which could mean a significant broadening of the probe. This is bad news for the younger Biden, and a huge political headache for his father, said Stephen Collinson in CNN. Even if Weiss finds no evidence that Joe Biden directly profited from Hunter's influence peddling, the appointment of a special counsel guarantees months of new material for Republicans seeking to portray President Biden as corrupt. Republicans had been demanding that Garland make Weiss a special counsel, but now are pivoting to the ludicrous claim that Weiss, a Republican and Trump appointee, is a stooge installed to help Democrats orchestrate what House Oversight Chair Representative James Comer called a Biden family cover-up. Comer's right, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Weiss's appointment is a farce. Special counsels are supposed to come from outside government, Instead, Garland picked the same U.S. attorney who forged that indefensible plea agreement, effectively shielding Hunter from additional charges. Weiss has never shown any interest in exploring whether the elder Biden, whom Hunter's business partner called the big guy in emails, played any direct role in the influence peddling scheme. Even if none of the estimated $20 million went into Joe Biden's bank account, said Jonathan Turley in the New York Post, the president clearly benefited. These funds were distributed through a labyrinth of shell companies to his son, brother, daughters-in-law, and grandchildren, a quick and easy way for Grandpa Biden to funnel substantial wealth to his descendants without heavy taxes or delays. Republican outrage over Hunter is cynical and performative, said John Cassidy in the New Yorker. The same GOP corruption fighters were utterly untroubled by then-President Donald Trump filling his pockets with far greater sums when foreign emissaries and lobbyists deliberately booked pricey rooms at his hotels. Trump also routinely billed taxpayers for rooms occupied by Secret Service agents and other federal employees. Nor does the House GOP have any interest in the $2 billion that the Saudi Arabian Wealth Fund invested in Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner's new investment firm. After Kushner steered U.S. policy to benefit Saudi Arabia and his personal friend, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. There's no doubt the Trump crimes and corruption were on a far greater scale, said Ankush Kordori in New York Magazine. Still, liberals should drop their move along, nothing to see here approach to the Hunter Biden scandal. There is no question he made millions trading off his father's name and government position, all with the then vice president's evident acquiescence. To be troubled by such blatant influence peddling doesn't make you an apologist for Trump or anyone in his family. So, good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for clarifications after Aditya Pai, a Democratic congressional candidate from California, announced via email that he was suspending his campaign due to a lack of joy. Pai quickly retracted that message, claiming that it was an emotional processing exercise distributed in error by a now former aide. It was a good week for remote work, with a Washington Post report that Senator Tommy Tuberville, ostensibly of Alabama, no longer owns property in the state and has been residing for years in a $3 million beach house in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. It was a good week for suicide missions, with a new poll showing Trump critic Chris Christie with a one-point lead over Ron DeSantis among New Hampshire GOP voters, just 40 points behind Trump. But it was a bad week for Germany, where news that a third of its trains were late last year has plunged the famously punctual nation into gloomy introspection. Late trains, said Professor of Transport Andreas Knie, are a cultural crisis for the German people. It was a bad week for sharing the wealth, with a Fox News report that the campaign committee of Senator Bernie Sanders sent $200,000 to a nonprofit Sanders Institute run by his wife, Jane, which employs her son, David, on a $152,653 salary. Finally, it was a bad week for following directions, after a New Zealand supermarket's AI-powered meal bot suggested a recipe for aromatic water mix that would produce deadly chlorine gas. The bot suggested serving the beverage chilled and enjoy the refreshing fragrance. The briefing this week is titled Fear in the Water. A spate of shark attacks off the northeast coast has swimmers and surfers on edge. What's behind the biting spree? Are shark attacks increasing? The number of people bitten by sharks worldwide has held steady at about 70 or 80 a year over the past decade. But the U.S. Northeast appears to account for a growing share of those attacks. At least 13 people have been bitten off New York's Long Island over the past two summers. That's more than in the previous two centuries. Earlier this month, New York City's popular Rockaway Beach had its first attack in seven decades when an unidentified shark bit a chunk from the leg of a 65-year-old swimmer. Attacks are also rising further north. In 2018, a boogie boarder was killed on the Cape Cod National Seashore, Massachusetts' first fatal attack since 1936. Maine saw its first fatal attack in 2020 when a great white tore into a woman paddling off Bailey Island. Sightings of great white sharks are now routine along the Cape's popular Atlantic beaches. The danger is much greater than it used to be, said Heather Doyle, chair of the shark safety nonprofit Cape Cod Ocean Community. The sharks have not always been here to this degree. Are there more sharks in the water? Shark populations have shrunk globally by about 70% over the past 50 years, largely due to overfishing of both the animals and the fish they eat. But that trend is reversing in the U.S. thanks to state and federal regulations that protect the sharks and their prey. In 2013, 15 East Coast states began limiting catches of menhaden, a major source for sharks. Those fish, also known as bunker, now thrive in New York's nearshore waters, bringing sharks close to swimmers and surfers. In Cape Cod, great whites have rebounded since a 1972 federal law banned the culling of gray seals, which the sharks feast on in summer and fall. The Cape is now home to a booming population of seals and some 800 great whites, one of the world's largest populations. Sharks are a sign of a healthy ecosystem, said Chris Paparo, a shark expert at Stony Brook University in Long Island. Some scientists believe global warming is also pushing more sharks to northeastern waters. Why are sharks on the move? As ocean temperatures hit record highs, sharks that prefer frigid water, such as great whites, may be heading further north to chillier seas. Meanwhile, sharks that normally inhabit warmer waters off Florida and the Carolinas, such as bull, tiger, and black-tipped sharks, can now comfortably roam all the way up to southern New England in summer. Hotter temperatures are also pushing more people to the beach in summer and into the water. There's more potential to increase interactions, said James Sulikowski, a marine biologist at Arizona State University. As his language indicates, marine scientists chafe at the term shark attack and urge the use of shark encounter or interaction. Why is that? While the 1975 blockbuster Jaws convinced many people that sharks are bloodthirsty man-eaters, the animals are actually not interested in hunting humans. They generally just ignore people, said Gavin Naylor, head of the Florida Program for Shark Research. If people knew how frequently they were in water with sharks, they would probably be surprised. Most bites happen by accident when a shark mistakes a moving limb for a fish or a surfboard for a seal. When they realize their mistake, they move on, which is why most shark encounters result in minor injuries. Only five fatal shark attacks were reported worldwide last year. How are authorities trying to protect beachgoers? New York has launched a $1 million program to use surveillance drones to spot sharks. Police patrol the beaches in helicopters while lifeguards roam the waters on jet skis. It's like a new world we're living in, said Carrie Epstein, a 25-year-old veteran lifeguard at Jones Beach on Long Island. On Cape Cod, officials once wary of spooking beachgoers have installed conspicuous warning signs and encouraged swimmers not to go in above their waists. They put tourniquets and bandages in bright orange boxes on beaches. An app, Sharktivity, tracks local sightings. Cape officials say they've been inundated with proposals for high-tech solutions, such as using sound waves to drive off sharks, but most have been ignored. It's more effective, say scientists, to teach the public to avoid behaviors that increase risks. What can swimmers do? Avoid taking a dip at dawn and dusk, when sharks typically feed, and stay away from areas where seals or schools of fish are present, or where seabirds are diving. Experts also recommend swimming in groups and avoiding murky waters where a shark might confuse them for marine life. When you enter the ocean, be aware that you're entering their home, said Hans Walters, a shark expert at the New York Aquarium. But the risks also need to be kept in perspective. More people are killed annually by cows and bees than by sharks. Your chances of being bitten are kind of like your chances of winning the Powerball, said Christopher Lowe, director of the Shark Lab at California State University, Long Beach. You have a much bigger risk just driving to the beach. Moving into the best columns, we'll read two from the U.S. this week. Biden's dangerous hostage deal. President Biden is making Americans ripe targets for hostage takers, said Noah Rothman. The U.S. reached a tentative deal with Iran last week to secure the release of five Americans unjustly imprisoned inside the Islamic Republic. In return for their freedom, some $6 billion in impounded Iranian assets will be unfrozen, money that the mullahs will supposedly be allowed to use only for humanitarian purposes. While it's welcome news that these Americans will no longer be brutalized in an Iranian prison, this deal shows the ease with which the U.S. is extorted by hostile foreign powers under Biden. The template was set during last year's negotiations with the Kremlin over WNBA star Brittany Griner. For the low, low price of taking one athlete hostage, Russia won the release of arms dealer and convicted hitman Viktor Bout. Now the Biden administration is reportedly scouring the West for infamous Russians it can trade for Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who is being held in a high-security Moscow prison on bogus spying charges. Biden wants to show the world that Americans do not leave their own behind, but all foreign autocrats see as the concessions they can win by seizing our citizens. A GOP plan to silence young voters. Vivek Ramaswamy has a bold plan to give Republicans a lock on power, said Jamel Bowie. And it involves stripping millions of Americans of their votes. The GOP presidential candidate is pitching a constitutional amendment that would raise the voting age from 18 to 25, with exceptions for those who pass a civics test or perform national service. Ramaswamy, polling third behind Donald Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, calls his plan a remedy for a loss of civic pride among Americans. What it's really trying to fix is the GOP's unpopularity with voters under 30, who broke for Democrats 68-31% in the 2022 midterms. Rather than appeal to this bloc, Ramaswamy would remove the vast majority from the electorate altogether. To be clear, this novelty policy from a novelty candidate is going nowhere. The country is so divided along partisan lines that the Constitution is effectively unamendable. But Ramaswamy's plan is yet more evidence of the GOP's turn against the principle of majority rule. You can see it in DeSantis' removal of elected prosecutors who disagree with him, and in Trump's attempt to end democracy after his 2020 defeat. Ramaswamy is playing the same song. There's almost no one in the Republican Party at this point who isn't. And this column comes from Germany. Rainforest destruction is our fault, too. Pony up and shut up. That was Brazil's message for Europe at last week's Amazon summit, said Nicholas Franzen. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva demanded that rich countries pay $100 billion each year towards saving the rainforest, an unfulfilled promise made back in 2009, and spare him the lectures about the evils of deforestation. The smackdown is well deserved. How can we lecture Brazil about the need to preserve the ecosystem when Europe clear-cut a large part of its own forest a century ago? The simple truth is that it is our demand for cheap goods that has fueled the destruction of the rainforest. A significant percentage of the raw materials and the crops that come from lands cleared in the Amazon region goes north. Germans and other Europeans buy Brazilian hardwoods for our flooring. We feed our pigs Brazilian soybeans. Even much of the beef we eat comes from Brazil, where, thanks to cheap, illegally cleared Amazon pasture land, raising cattle costs half what it does here. We want cheap groceries. South America delivers. In turn, those agricultural exports fuel Brazil's economy. We can't expect a country or its farmers to forego that income without some compensation. It is only logical that the industrialized nations should dig into their pockets. After all, we are the primary driver of the global climate emergency. The Last Word, feature article. Title this week, Chased by a Wall of Fire. One of the deadliest wildfires in U.S. history engulfed Maui's Lahaina with almost no warning, said Joshua Partlow in the Washington Post. Residents who survived barely escaped the inferno. Lisa Vorpal, a bank teller, woke to the sound of someone shuffling on her lanai. It was 3 a.m. on Tuesday when she looked out her bedroom window along a dry, grassy slope overlooking her slice of tropical paradise and realized it was just the wind. Alexa Kasky couldn't sleep either. On the farm where she grew taro and breadfruit for her plant-based restaurant, she listened to gusts that would dislodge a garage door and topple the Hong Kong orchid tree outside. Photographer Rachel Zimmerman woke up before dawn in her condo on Front Street, Lahaina's seaside boulevard of restaurants and surf shops, to the howls rattling her window screens. If there was any warning that fitful night that Hawaii was about to endure one of the most horrific and deadly natural disasters in the state's history, it was only the wind. For 2 days, National Weather Service employees in Honolulu had been sending out ominous alerts about powerful easterly gusts whipped up by Hurricane Dora passing 500 miles to the south. They hit Maui at a time when much of the tropical island had been parched by severe drought, including the drier leeward side that includes Lahaina. The next time Vorpal woke up, she smelled smoke. The power was out. A fire had started in the dry grass near her home on Lahaina Luna Road, on a slope just east of the highway that bypasses downtown. Power poles fell in the neighborhood and wires had snapped, leading several neighbors to later question whether electrical equipment had started the blaze. Maui County authorities got the first reports of the fire by 6:37 a.m., and not long afterward, police were circulating in her neighborhood, calling out on megaphones for people to evacuate. Using a nearby hydrant, firefighters doused the flames. She didn't feel panicked. Fires were a regular occurrence. The blaze was small and didn't appear threatening as she and her husband, Eddie, drove past. "It's Hawaii," she said. Nobody thought anything of it. They spent a few hours at their daughter's apartment, but returned home after Maui County at 9:55 a.m. sent out an alert that the brush fire was 100% contained. It looked that way to Eddie. Nothing was happening. A couple fire engines were there. They were all packing stuff up, he said. It looked 100% fine. Lahaina sits on Maui's western flank, a historic town rimmed by white sand beaches at the foot of the ancient Puhu Kukui volcano. On most days, it's a postcard-perfect symbol of tropical bliss. But an early morning blaze was ominous, and Mark Steffel, a tile setter, had reason to be wary. He lived down the hill on Lahaina Luna Road in a home he rebuilt after another wildfire burned it down 5 years ago. He had heard that the early morning blaze had been extinguished. Around 2:30 p.m., he heard his wife Michelle shout, "Oh my God!" The blaze had kicked up again farther down the hillside. Wind dragged the flames toward Lahaina. It was still a few hundred yards away. Mark tried to reassure Michelle that firefighters would handle it, but the speed of its approach was like nothing he had seen. Within minutes, there was a wall of fire 30 yards from the house, he said. Overhead, dry air, the result of a high-pressure system, was jetting over and down the slopes of the volcano, sending ferocious winds into his town, spraying gravel and ripping shingles off the rooftops. It was a worst-case scenario that some emergency planners had long warned about. The couple scrambled to gather their dogs and cats. One rescue dog, Poppy, got left behind in the chaos. Steffel hit the gas in his truck as flames licked out the side of the house. "I was praying to God that we didn't die," he said. Not far away on Komomai Street, Anastasia Angel Pang saw the distant fire marching closer. The Lahaina native and family members, her grandmother, her mother, various cousins, live within blocks of one another, and all had decided to leave. Pang, 31, texted her husband, who had left early that day to work in another town, to see what he wanted her to pack for him. He replied 8 minutes later, but by then her backyard was in flames, and she hastily fled alongside a caravan of relatives. As she drove away with her dogs and a few clothes she had grabbed, she could hear the sound of propane tanks exploding up and down the street, one after another. "When I looked back, all I saw was black smoke," she said. "It was then that I knew, if we come back, we're coming back to nothing." By this time, the same black cloud was starting to smother Lahaina. The town of 12,000 had been the capital of the former Hawaiian kingdom and a trade hub for 19th century whaling ships. Lahaina had the oldest house in Maui, the Baldwin Home Museum, and a treasured banyan tree that has grown in a courtyard by the sea for 150 years. These days, tourists come to surf or snorkel, sunbathe, and zipline. Caress Carson, 41, catered to those visitors at her job at Captain Jack's Island Grill. She had spent nearly two decades in Lahaina and valued its rich history. Mark Twain had visited the Pioneer Inn across the street from Captain Jack's. She liked to imagine herself tracing his long-ago footsteps. Even though the power was out, Carson had reported to work that afternoon to help keep food from spoiling. On the drive in, she passed the home of her boss, Sam, and watched a chunk of his roof as big as her truck get ripped off by the wind. And she and Sam hauled bags of ice. Black smoke started billowing through town. It came on in an instant. All of a sudden, it was starting to barrel over the building, Carson said. It was completely black. You couldn't see an inch in front of you. This was broiling smoke. Zimmerman, the photographer, was also downtown. She grabbed a small safe with her hard drives, passport, and some cash, plus her computer, some food for her dog, Zaya, and a handful of shirts. At 3:38 p.m., already fearing the worst, she snapped a few hasty photos of their rooms, their closets, their furniture, thinking she might need the pictures for insurance claims. She called her parents in Colorado a half hour later, saying she and her partner, Nicole, were stuck in traffic as the fire bore down, and she didn't know whether they would make it out. They encouraged her to stick close to the ocean and to just keep going. Carson was also trying to drive out of Lahaina in her Nissan pickup. Glowing embers showered into her open window, perforating the blanket in the back seat. There was gridlock downtown as panicked people tried to escape, and others abandoned their vehicles. Carson watched a couple running barefoot through the streets pushing a stroller. She watched person after person run down the side streets until they got to the seawall and then threw themselves into the Pacific Ocean. Carson recorded video on her phone as she drove, searching for a way out. Power lines and palm trees whipped around wildly. She came to a road that was blocked by a downed utility pole. "I don't know if I'm going to make it," she recorded herself saying. "I don't know what I'm going to do. Look at that. That's all burnt debris. The fire's getting closer and closer." It was 4:25 p.m. when she saw her friend, Kaleo, get hit in the head by a piece of debris. "Get in the car," she screamed to him. "Get in my car." He was panting. "Oh, my God," she said. The air was black. Carson was disoriented. A light emerged in the sky. "Look at the moon," she told him. "Look at the effing moon, dude." It was 4:30 p.m. He told her it was the sun. There was no emergency siren, no organized evacuation, few instructions about how to proceed, just a headlong grasp towards survival. Annalise Cochran, a 30-year-old who worked for an ocean conservation nonprofit, couldn't get out by car, and the building next to her was on fire, so she ran to the water. She saw her neighbor, Freeman, 86, struggling to walk. Another neighbor, Edna, was with him. Together, the three climbed over the rocky barrier to get away from the flames. "They spent hours in the water and on the rocks," Cochran said, "trying to stay away from flying embers and choking smoke. Cars abandoned on Front Street began to explode. Waves of heat and toxic fumes washed over the sea. At times, they had to move toward the fire when they began to feel dangerously cold." Cochran watched in horror as people held on to debris and floated away from shore. "People still chose just to drift out," she said. By that time, Kevin Foley, 42, was stranded in a Safeway parking lot, flames encroaching on multiple sides. He had been heading to his bartending shift at Longhi's Kanapali, an Italian restaurant in Marriott's Maui Ocean Club, when the smoke forced him off the bus. He walked back to where he had left his bike. Worried about his roommates, Foley tried to ride home but kept getting blocked. As he moved, he recorded fires all around him. When darkness fell, the sky turned a menacing orange. He watched flaming utility poles spraying showers of embers onto the pavement. He saw the fire consume a three-story apartment building on Kiowa Street. He narrated the conflagration as he traveled. "When sparks landed at the base of a palm tree and blossomed into flame," he said, "this is how it starts. One little spark flies to an area, and the next thing you know, it goes up, just like that. Sometime after midnight, a man staggered out from the burning homes toward a Shell gas station. His shorts were smoldering. Skin was peeling from his face. He collapsed onto the pavement. Foley encouraged the man to stand and led him toward Safeway. Foley rode around looking for help until he found a police officer. Maui police and firefighters had been out throughout the day trying to save lives and help people evacuate. But the fire was overwhelming. The cop couldn't do anything for him, Foley recalled. He just gave him water. Foley and some other people entered the Lahaina Cannery Mall, connected to the supermarket, to try to escape the smoke and wait out the night. Every so often, he would go outside to see whether the Safeway had started to burn. In the dark, cold water off Lahaina on Tuesday night, Cochran and her neighbor Edna clutched each other, both women shivering and struggling to breathe through the smoke and fumes. Cochran felt like she was losing consciousness. The women tried to stay awake. They talked about their families and promised each other they'd make it. At one point, Cochran called out to Freeman, her elderly neighbor, who was a little further down the rocky beach, and asked how he was. He smiled and made a shaka gesture with his hand, hang loose, to indicate he was all right. Later, she saw him slumped against the wall, unmoving. She believes he might have died from the smoke. Sometime around midnight, firefighters rescued Cochran and several dozen other people from the water. She has spent the past few nights at shelters. Her body is covered with bruises and lacerations. Her feet and face are burned. I feel blessed to be alive, she said. This story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a health and science piece. A breakthrough for postpartum depression. The Food and Drug Administration has approved the first ever pill specifically for postpartum depression, a breakthrough for a condition that affects about 1 in 8 new mothers in the U.S. Zuranolone, which will be sold under the brand name Zurzuvae, Z-U-R-Z-U-V-A-E, was shown in clinical trials to begin easing depressive symptoms within just 3 days, much faster than general-purpose antidepressants. And the course lasts only 2 weeks rather than many months. It is also the first treatment for the condition that can be taken at home. The only other option, brexanolone, is an expensive IV infusion that requires a 3-day stay in the hospital. The researchers cautioned that the trials followed patients for only 45 days and didn't involve women who'd breastfed or who had depression before giving birth. Still, the findings are hugely encouraging for a condition that can interfere with a mother's ability to care for her infant or other children and can cause significant emotional distress. It can even be fatal. Suicide is a leading cause of maternal deaths within a year of childbirth. Yet fewer than 10% of women with perinatal depression get treatment. We need to improve screening. We need to improve access to care. And we need to improve the treatments that are available to women so they have choices, Christina Delaganidis, one of the doctors who led the clinical trials, tells Bloomberg. Just 2,400 steps will help. If you're not hitting 10,000 steps a day, don't sweat it. That supposedly magical number for optimal fitness was actually made up back in the 1960s by a Japanese marketing executive promoting a new pedometer. Now the largest study of its kind, covering data on more than 225,000 people across multiple countries, has shown that the real daily target should be much lower, just 2,337 steps to be exact. That, scientists concluded, is the minimum required to reduce your risk of dying prematurely from heart disease or stroke. Still, if you can keep going, you should. Push it up to 3,967 steps, and you'll cut your risk of dying from any cause. Walk even farther, and those health benefits will continue to increase all the way up to at least 20,000 steps a day, with each extra 1,000 steps associated with another 15% reduced risk of dying from any cause. Our study confirms that the more you walk, the better. Lead author Manek Banak from the Medical University of Lodz in Poland tells The Times, "We found that this applied to both men and women, irrespective of age." And over on the Talking Points page, we have an article, "Young Republicans, the Racists in Their Midst." "Rising young stars of the mainstream right keep being outed as bigots," said Anthony L. Fisher in the Daily Beast, "raising unsettling questions about modern conservatism. First, influential pro-Ron DeSantis blogger Pedro Gonzalez was exposed for writing anti-Semitic and racist commentary on group chats. Weeks later, a speechwriter for DeSantis' campaign, Nate Hochman, was fired after he created and posted a video superimposing Nazi imagery over the Florida governor's face. Then rising conservative star Richard Hanania was revealed to have spewed racist bile under an alias on an alt-right website in past years. Calling himself a race realist, Hanania argued against miscegenation and in favor of sterilization for low IQ people, who he said were typically black Hispanics. He wrote, "lack the IQ to be productive part of a first world nation." These unveilings suggest the right needs a spiritual house cleaning, but it's a conversation that few conservatives want to have. "Young right-wing culture has changed since Donald Trump's ascendant," said David French in the New York Times. "Blatantly racist, sexist, and homophobic speech abounds among the so-called new right, who are united against a woke left they regard as an existential threat. Insecure in their masculinity, they deliver a vicious backlash to any contrary voices, whom they view as capitulators in the great battle against the forces of darkness. It's true that a Nietzschean right has become more prominent in recent years," said Matthew Schmitz in the American Conservative. "Still, its members remain marginal figures who have few followers outside Twitter. But the left leaps on cases like Hanania or to tar all conservatives as bigots." "Hanania is no fringe figure," said Christopher Mathias at HuffPost. "He's a right-wing star who has lectured at Yale and written for the Wall Street Journal. Elon Musk replies approvingly to his tweets, and Silicon Valley billionaire Mark Andreessen has appeared on his podcast. Such fans now profess shock at Hananiah's past comments," said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. "But he's made almost identical remarks under his own name. Hananiah recently said America needs more incarceration and surveillance of black people, and that liberals dislike anyone acknowledging statistical differences between races. This ugly affair makes clear that the only difference between tech titans decrying wokeness and red hats screaming at Trump rallies is optics. At the end of the day, they share the same vile bigotries." And we'll read a few of the short notes. More than 300 high-level military officers are unable to assume their positions due to a block on Senate approvals of military promotions by Senator Tommy Tuberville, the Republican from Alabama. The top spots in the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps are vacant as a result of the blockade launched to protest a Pentagon policy that pays expenses for service members who must travel to another state for an abortion. Nearly 49,500 people took their own lives in the U.S. last year, the highest number on record and about 3% above the toll in 2021. The widening availability of guns is driving the trend, said suicide researcher Jill Harkavy Friedman. Suicide attempts involving firearms are far more likely to result in death than those using other means. About 30 cents of every dollar spent so far this year by Donald Trump's various political committees has gone to legal fees and investigation-related bills. In total, the group spent some $27 million on legal costs in the first 6 months of 2023. On the poll watch, 66% of American adults say they have a personal or family connection to alcohol or drug addiction. Of those, 76% say it has had an impact on their family relationships. Whites, 67%, are more likely to have a family members who suffer with addiction than blacks, 58%, or Hispanics, 56%. And we'll finish the show with a quote from Edmund Burke, quoted in Adventist Today, who says, "No one made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could do only a little." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.